This is 9/11 Freefall.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 9/11 Freefall. My name is Andy Steele, and I am the host. Tonight, we'll be joined by historian and author Daniel Ganser. We'll be talking about 9/11 and also a large part about Operation Gladio. You might have heard about it, and if you haven't, then you'll be learning more about it tonight. That's all coming your way in just a few moments.
The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
Ganser is a Swiss historian. He heads the Swiss Institute for Peace and Energy Research in Basel. He's known as having written the definitive book on Operation Gladio called NATO's Secret Armies. He also wrote Rebuilding Native Nations, Strategies for Governance and Development, and a number of other books. He is a member of the 9/11 Consensus Panel. We'll be learning more about him today if you are not already aware. He's done some important research. Daniel, welcome to 9/11 Freefall.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
So for our audience members who aren't familiar with you yet, please tell our audience more about yourself and your own personal history.
Well, my name is Daniel. I'm in Switzerland right now as we talk, in Basel, so that's in the German-speaking part of Switzerland. I am 47 years old. I have a PhD in history, and my interest has always been into secret warfare. So I wrote my PhD on Operation Gladio. There's friends in the United States, William Bloom and Noam Chomsky, who said, why don't you look at that? Because a lot of the data is in Italian and in French and in German. And they said, we in the U.S. don't speak so much Italian. And I happen to be born in the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland. So I speak Italian and I speak French and I speak German. So I could read these documents. And that's why I did my PhD on Operation Gladio. And I happened to do my PhD on terrorism and manipulation of terrorism in September 2001. So actually, I was just going into the exams here at Basel University when 9/11 happened.
That's really interesting. And first of all, I didn't know there was an Italian-speaking region of Switzerland. Where is that?
There is, yes. Yeah, there's three. It's a very small country, Switzerland. It's just 8 million people. And the biggest part of it is German, German-speaking. So I'm living in Basel, in the German-speaking place. And I taught history at Basel University here, German-speaking students. But we also have an Italian part, which borders to Italy, Lugano, Locarno, Bellinzona, other places. And that's where I was born, so I speak Italian. And we also have a French-speaking part. It's funny. It's a very small country with three languages.
All very good stuff. And I think it's really smart to learn a lot of languages, especially when you are young. That's what they always say, is that when you're very young, your brain's still developing. And so you can learn five different languages. But as you get older, your brain gets used to speaking one language your whole life, and it becomes harder to pick up the different ways of putting a sentence together. So I had to learn all of this in the Peace Corps. So I wish I had learned more languages when I was younger. But no, that's very good. And of course, you've done some very important work. You mentioned that you were a PhD student when 9/11 happened. Can you tell our audience that story of how you heard the news that the United States was under attack that day?
My situation was that I had worked on terrorism in 98, 99, and in 2000. And other history students, I was working at Basel University in Switzerland, and I was working in London at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And other PhD students whom I was hanging out with, they were saying, why do you research terrorism? That's really, you know, it's just not interesting. That, you know, that's an old story from maybe the 70s. You can look at the Irish Republican Army or the Red Brigades in Italy or Old Armee Fraktion in Germany. But terrorism is so boring. Nobody's going to ever talk about this again. This is old stuff. It's never going to come back. Why don't you research globalization? You know, that'd be much better for your career and stuff. And I said, well, you know, might be old-fashioned, but I just think terrorism is really interesting, how they manipulated the Italian population with terrorism, just created fear. And, you know, I found out there were secret armies and the CIA was involved. And so my friend said, it's very interesting, but we think it's, you know, really far away from the current debate. And then my professor said, you have to take your exam, and the exam will be on September 27, 2001. And I was just sitting down preparing for my exam, getting ready to talk about terrorism, about secret warfare, about the secret services and state terrorism, basically also. And then suddenly the attacks happened. And obviously I was... I was just thinking in a special way already then. I was thinking, okay, is this false flag terrorism? Are the secret services involved? Is this really Al-Qaeda? Is it, what are the facts? What's going on? And above all, I was worried that they will ask me at the exam about this current event. So immediately I put the folder on my shelf and I collected all the data, and they didn't ask me then. They didn't ask me a word about 9/11, although it had just happened, but everybody was still thinking it was too fresh and that we couldn't talk about it.
You know, that's interesting, because I would imagine that you had friends while you were studying this stuff. You probably talked about what you were studying at least occasionally, and you were already aware of false flag terrorism, and it sounds like you were also very aware and open to talking about it. And I want to know, was the attitude that people have now when you talk about it, the knee-jerk reaction that they respond with to say that's just out of bounds or I don't want to hear about it, the cognitive dissonance, was that prevalent in the society when you talked about this before 9/11, or were people more open-minded to hearing about these kinds of things?
And no, it was always difficult, I really have to say. It was always difficult because I was, before I was working on Operation Gladio, I was working on the Cuban Missile Crisis, and there's another book I had to write during my studies. And then I looked how the CIA made the invasion of Cuba in 1961, and then afterwards in 1962, how the Soviets put nuclear missiles into Cuba. And at that time, I was really interested to look at the details and how they would sort of, you know, cover up their operations. And I found out that the CIA, when they bombed Cuba in 61, had actually painted the name of the Cuban Air Force on the planes that they had used to bomb Cuba. The Cuban military is called Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias, FAR. And so the CIA just painted FAR on the planes and then dropped bombs on Cuba. And when Fidel Castro shot down one of the planes, he saw, okay, gee, they painted actually, you know, my army sign on that plane. And in the UN Security Council in New York, I looked at the data then, how the debate was there, and there was, of course, the ambassador of Cuba said, well, the United States is attacking us. That was in 61. And the U.S. ambassador said, no, this is an internal Cuban affair. And the proof is, if you look at the pictures, these planes are Cuban planes. And he just, you know, pointed to the letters on the planes. And then the Cuban ambassador said, well, they know that's all lies. And the American ambassador said, of course, we wouldn't lie. And, you know, it's funny, already then I looked at this deeper level of international politics, and I was fully aware that lies and violence mix a lot, and I was always interested in that. I looked at Operation Northwoods that you obviously know, and I talked about it when I was teaching my students, because I was after you do a PhD in Switzerland, and it's probably similar in the United States, you work at the university and you teach your students and you tell them about international politics, and you give them specific examples. And we also looked at Operation Northwood, which in 1962 suggested to blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and then blame it on Cuba. As we all know, the operation was never carried out, but we do have the original documents. And when you ask me, was it easier to talk about that then, I have to say no. It was always difficult. People were always going like, no, Dan, that's not possible, or how could anybody blow up a ship and then blame somebody else? That's really crazy, and that's interesting, but it's really hard to imagine. And so you have all these obstacles in your head that actually make it difficult to research this field.
Right, even though it's right on paper, you can prove it. People just don't want to hear it. Now, regarding 9/11, there was a note passed to me by the person who set up this interview that you say you can tell me how you got in trouble about Building 7. How did you get in trouble about Building 7?
First, I was just reading, you know, I wasn't even talking about it because I was happy to have my PhD. I was like 29 years or so old, and I was working at university, and you're always working with a yearly contract. So you don't get like a job contract for many years, so just for 1 year, and you have to basically prove that you're a good scientist, and the others watch you very closely. So I was very aware of that situation, and then I was teaching history classes, and I was working on covert action operations. You know, I told them about Operation Gladio. I told them how the CIA had overthrown the government in Iran, how the CIA had attacked Cuba, how they had overthrown the government in Guatemala. And the students finally said, yeah, Dr. Gans, that's all very interesting. Thanks for giving these courses. But how about 9/11? Isn't that, you know, that's also very unclear what happened there. And then, to be very honest with you, in the beginning, I was very shy to talk about it because I knew that nobody else in Switzerland was talking about it. Nobody was teaching anything else than just the official narrative. And I had my questions in my mind, and I was saying, yeah, you know, this year we cannot work about on this. We have to wait until the official report, that's the Keene-Hamilton report, is published. And it came out in 2004. As you know. And then when the Keene-Hamilton report was published, 600 pages, I took it and I told my students, that was still at Basel University, and I was also teaching at Zurich University. I told my students, you're then with some 30 students, it's like half of them are men, other group are women, they're all between 20 and 25 years old. They have very, you know, broad and open perspective on the world. And I gave them the 9/11 Commission report and told them to look specifically for World Trade Center 7, because I said, that's a very interesting point, and I want you to focus on this and see whether it's mentioned in the report, and if yes, if the collapse is explained. And obviously, I knew already that it's mentioned, but that the collapse is not mentioned. So, you know, the official narrative misses one building, and I thought, this is really hilarious. I thought, you can't publish a book 600 pages long and you miss out the building. And for the students, it was very interesting to just realize that the number of buildings mentioned in the official U.S. narrative is not correct. And I gave them other books to read, one book from David Ray Griffin and another book from Michael Rupert, Crossing the Rubicon. And then I told them, now, if you take these three different books, Griffin, Rupert, and Keene-Hamilton, what conclusions do you actually reach, you know, if you look at this and that perspective? And that made them very aware. That made them very interested in the whole topic. And the good thing was, we were really working at university level with no press at all. Okay, there was no journalist in this classroom. I was just doing my teaching and everything went fine. But later it became more problematic. The moment when it became problematic was in 2006 when I published an article in the Swiss daily Tages Anzeiger. So that's a very well-known newspaper in Switzerland. And I published an entire page on World Trade Center 7. I didn't say, you know, that it was blown up with explosives. I said it was either blown up with explosives or it collapsed due to fire. And I really left it open between fire and explosives. Although I thought, it would, you know, the fire story was not very convincing, but I left it to the audience. And at that point, my, you know, other professors at the at the Center for Security Studies where I was working were really putting pressure on me and saying, you know, you should shut up and don't publish articles like that and you'll ruin your career. And that was really sad for me to see, because I thought Switzerland is a free country and we can actually research whatever we want. And then I realized that it's even in Switzerland very, very difficult to talk about 9/11. Yeah, that was it. I mean, even the U.S. Embassy in Switzerland said that people, that they're obviously for free speech, they said that, but they said that people who have high positions, I was with a PhD at a leading university, people with high positions, they should be very careful what they say. That's basically what they said. And obviously they labeled me a conspiracy theorist, which I thought was just ludicrous, because I said, you know, I've been talking to experts here in Switzerland. They say with high probability World Trade Center 7 was destroyed by controlled demolition. So, and that was in 2006. And then really the problem started that the university would not renew the contract.
Right. Well, we saw that happen here in the United States, obviously, too. I had always thought that we were a country of free and open thought. You would have situations where...
We both thought, really? We thought that. And then put to the test, we were proven wrong.
Well, the times that we grew up in, we didn't have any major events like this. I mean, there were things that happened, things like Oklahoma City and all of this, but the people who were able to give alternative views of it were not very well heard. So you grow up thinking that what you hear on TV is the true and legitimate opinions. And you would hear some variation of opinions from two sides of a debate, usually about politics. So you think that there's free and open expression and shared ideas here. But then when you actually hear someone talking about something like this, where at first your knee-jerk reaction is to think, well, that's just ridiculous. But then you hear them and you hear the arguments and you see it for yourself and realize that it's very reasonable and very good. And then it becomes like some kind of scary waking up moment when you see the reactions of everyone around you. So we begin to see everything unfurl in our society for ourselves personally, because it's like there's things there that we didn't see before, methods of control that we didn't see before.
For me personally, it was really also a media training, because I realized that, you know, one newspaper can give you the possibility to publish something. I mean, they gave me a whole page to talk about World Trade Center 7, and people here in Switzerland generally don't even know that a third building collapsed. And so, you know, with that page, I had some opportunity to just educate them about that fact. But the newspaper has different outlets, and, you know, the owners have also another newspaper. And with that other newspaper, they attacked me. So they really play the game with you. And once you realize you're just in the middle of a crossfire that you can't control, it's really hard. And the only thing that I did then, and I'm still very happy about that, is that I made public talks and I recorded them and put them on YouTube. And I think as long as we have YouTube, and we still have it, and we can put out our analysis there, I was able to at least present my data, because mainstream television channels and mainstream newspapers were, and still are to this very day, I mean, we're now in 2020, but they're still very, very closed to any specific 9/11 debate that involves World Trade Center 7 or involves data that says World Trade Center 7 was blown up. I mean, that's what I now say publicly in Switzerland, and very few people want to hear it, but I still say it. You know, I think basically as a historian, you just have to stand with your facts. And I'm obviously fully aware that 500 years ago, people like us were burned. So now we're not being burned, but we do get some criticism from here and there. But that's what we have to live with.
Right. Well, I just look at the term conspiracy theorist. You can call it a conspiracy theorist. To me, it's a made-up term. It's like someone calling me a nanny boo. There's no such thing. So if somebody calls me that, I don't even pay attention to it, or I just laugh at it. And I don't really have much respect for people who say that as a knee-jerk reaction to hearing an argument for something. So it doesn't bother me anyway, because I don't respect the person who's saying it. So there's ways of dealing with our modern society and their reactions to what we talk about. Now, you wrote a book called NATO's Secret Armies, and before we get into discussing the subject of that book, which is Operation Gladio, I want to ask you, why do you feel it's important to understand that operation when looking at 9/11 and all the evidence that we were lied to about that event?
I think it really helps us to understand there is a deeper layer to international politics. I think that is what Operation Gladio teaches us. It's a story that proves, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that secret warfare is something that is being done and that has an effect. And, you know, as long as people remain in this illusion that secret warfare does not exist, it is very, very difficult to talk about it. So I think Operation Gladio helps us to understand that secret warfare is a reality, to understand that, you know, secret services can create fear by creating an act of terrorism. It always creates fear. I mean, that's the main idea about it. Shock the population, put them into some emotional state of despair, fear, and anger. You can actually create that. And furthermore, that false flag is a strategy which has been used for many, many years. It's just you do something and you blame somebody else. I mean, it's not really complicated, but it's important to have specific examples where students can educate their mind, get their thinking around it. Because if you don't, if you can't think it, you cannot understand it. And I hope Operation Gladio helps people to understand that pattern.
Absolutely, and this has been fully acknowledged. So we're not sitting there speculating about something that may or may not have happened. This was blown wide open quite a while ago. But we're going to be getting into a little bit of the details today. Obviously, this is just an hour-long show. We probably can't get into everything, but the good thing is that you can get Mr. Ganser's book here, which we'll be telling you how to get by the end of the show. But remembering that our audience may not be familiar with this topic, let's be teachers here, and let's start with the basics. Can you please tell our audience what Operation Gladio was?
Okay, Gladio is actually a short Roman sword. People know Gladiator, I guess, from the movie. And they were fighting 2,000 years ago in the Colosseum in Rome. And this two-edged sword can cut in two directions. And that's actually very telling, because the Operation Gladio, as it was called, was an operation that was first came to public knowledge in 1990. So at the time when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and George Bush Sr. then started Operation Desert Storm, so that's 30 years ago, that's when the cover of Operation Gladio was blown. It was blown in Italy by Italian Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti, who was then in power. And he said, okay, in Italy we had a secret army, and this secret army was called Gladio. And this was a huge shock to the entire population in Italy, because in every democracy, you can't have a secret army. You can have an army, yes, but then the budget and the members of the army must be known to parliament and must be known to the press. And Giulio Andreotti said, you know, this secret army was unknown to parliament, and therefore it was unconstitutional. I mean, historians went like, Jesus Christ, you have a secret army. So where do you have that secret army? And then he explained that this secret army was integrated into the Defense Department. And within the Defense Department, which in Italy was called Servizio Informazione e Difesa, SID, you have the Military Secret Service. And this Military Secret Service, again, as a subsection, and that was the secret army. So you couldn't find it. You know, you wouldn't find it on a chart of the government where you can see Defense Department, Secret Service. Then, you know, you wouldn't indicate that within the Secret Service, Military Secret Service, there's Operation Gladio. So it was hidden, it was secret, and it was unconstitutional. But the real bombshell was that Giulio Andreotti said, and he was really with his back to the wall, he said, and this secret army does not only exist in Italy, but it exists in all countries of Western Europe. It also exists in Switzerland, it exists in France, it exists in Germany, in Belgium, and it exists in Holland, and, you know, all over Western Europe. And so the French, for instance, President de Gaulle was really, you know, he was really yeah, he was not happy with this store, and he said, no, the French would never do that. And then Andreotti went forward and said, there is a secret unit. It's called the Allied Clandestine Committee, and it meets in Brussels, and it's just the heads of the military secret services, and they coordinate this stay behind the army. And they had their last meeting just like 2 months ago in 1990, that was. So then the French had to admit that they had also taken part in that meeting. And then the Parliament of the European Union went really crazy and said, how can that be? Why do we have secret armies in Western Europe? And Giulio Andreotti, Italian Prime Minister, made it even more exciting by saying, these secret armies were set up by the CIA and the MI6 after World War II. To fight a Soviet invasion. So he said, you know, these networks were so-called stay-behind networks. That's a military term. A stay-behind network is actually an army which becomes operative once the regular armed forces are defeated, and the stay-behind network would then become operative on territory already controlled by enemy forces. It would operate behind enemy lines, you know, would blow up bridges, and it would just fight the Red Army in France and in Germany and Italy, had the Red Army invaded Western Europe. And which was really, really interesting that is that Andreotti then said, and the whole thing is coordinated by NATO. So NATO had to take a stand. And the NATO spokesman first said, no, we don't do secret warfare. And the next day, when more details had surfaced, NATO had to admit, yes, we do secret warfare, but we can't comment. So that was the story. I thought it was really hilarious. And then the different NATO ambassadors, you have to keep in mind that Germany has a NATO ambassador, Italy has a NATO ambassador, of course, France, everybody has a NATO ambassador. They didn't even know about the secret army. So the NATO ambassadors were hitting at the doors in Brussels, and they were asking NATO Supreme Headquarters, Allied Power Europe, they were saying, what's going on? And then high-ranking officers had American officers and British officers confirmed that these secret networks existed. And they said, you know, it was a good idea to have them during the Cold War, because had there been an invasion of the Soviet Union, had the Soviet Union invaded Western Europe, it would have been great to have these secret armies. And so the story rested a little bit on that level, that it was just some sort of defense of Western Europe. And people went like, okay, if it's that, then okay, the Soviet Union didn't invade, then we had that, and didn't use it, so, you know, wasn't important. But then there's another story to the whole structure, which is the internal structure. Should I explain that as well?
Absolutely. And also, can you explain, when you say secret army, I mean, I think of these exciting movies where you have some guy who might be a meek school teacher, and then some things go down, some invasions, and he suddenly you realize that he's part of the secret clandestine army and he's ready to go out and fight. Was it like that? Were these ordinary citizens blended into society that just knew where weapons were buried and things like that?
Yeah, it's a little bit like that, because these secret armies had to have arms supplies independent of the regular forces. So in Italy, they buried the arms on cemeteries, or in Austria, they buried the arms in the woods or in the mountains, and in Switzerland, they were having structures within the mountains where they'd have these arms. They also had gold there, because we need gold once we're occupied. You know, the currencies will default, and we need one currency which will still work. And they also had radio equipment, because they said, if, you know, Western Europe is occupied by the Red Army, by the Soviet Union, then, of course, we will have NATO planes flying above Western Europe, bombing the Soviets. And when the Soviets shoot them down, the task of the secret armies would also have been, and they, you know, trained this, to capture a pilot, a shot-down pilot, and exfiltrate him from enemy-held territory to the coast, where, you know, a submarine would pick them up. So they would do all these exercises with submarines and parachuting and sending encrypted communication from one station to the other. They really trained, but they had to train this while Europe was, you know, not at war. I mean, people were not allowed to notice. So children of men who were in the secret army said, "Oh, I remember my dad. You know, we always went on holidays at the same place in Sweden or in Norway. And he was always away, I mean, for 2 or 3 weeks. And we were with my mother and we had a good time. But we didn't really know what dad was doing." So it's very much like these movies you talk about, because the dad was in the secret army and they had trainings and they were training their stay behind networks where they would, you know, where they could actually meet and communicate and shoot and where they would find the arms caches and everything. So that was a very secret structure. But one Italian general, Gerardo Serravalle, who was one of the leading generals of that Operation Gladio, he said when the CIA came to inspect the state of Operation Gladio — Gladio was the code name of the Italian secret army. In Germany, it was called Stay Behind. In Switzerland, it was called P26. In Belgium, it was called SDR8. So they had different names in different countries, but the overall term is Stay Behind, and the best well-known term is Operation Gladio. So Gerardo Serravalle in Italy said, and this is really the interesting part, he said the CIA was not really interested in our preparations for the Soviet invasion. When they came to visit, they wanted to know whether we were able, and now that's very important, whether we were able to influence domestic politics and whether we were able to keep the communists from power, okay? And that is now the second story of Operation Gladio. I told you in the beginning, Gladio is this Roman sword, and it has two edges. And this is a very good picture for the whole thing, because one edge is a secret network of soldiers with arms and explosives that becomes operative in case of a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. Okay, that never happened. We didn't have a Soviet invasion. But the other edge of that sword is you can use that structure to create fear in Western Europe if you want, because it is a structure that nobody knows about. Nobody can trace it. No judge can say, gee, we have to look whether Gladio was involved, because nobody even knew that Gladio existed. So now today that we know that Gladio existed, the really interesting debate is, were these secret soldiers, were these networks, were these explosives that were buried in many different parts of the country, were they used in terrorist attacks? And so the first thing I did is I ran through the different countries and I checked, was there a terrorist attack in, say, Switzerland? And there was none. So, you know, you already have the answer. Okay, P26, which was the secret arm in Switzerland, was not involved in terrorism. They just prepared for the invasion, and the invasion didn't come, full stop, that's it. Then I checked in Italy. They had the secret army, yes. Was it linked to NATO? Yes. Was it linked to CIA and MI6? Yes. Was there terrorism in Italy? And the answer is yes. And then that's really the tricky and the complicated work for the historian, to link or to search for the links of the secret armies to these acts of terrorism. And that's still, you know, ongoing research, but you know, I could advance the research to quite a point. And obviously it's like with 9/11, you get to a certain point and after that you don't really know what happened, but you see that there were links to terrorism. And then also in Greece and in Turkey, we even had a coup d'etat during the Cold War. You know, Europe wasn't just nothing, freedom and peace country. In Greece, we had a coup d'etat in 67, and in Turkey, we had several coup d'etat, one of which in 1980. And there again, the secret armies were involved. So, yeah, fascinating stuff.
I think it's very fascinating how this was manipulated, turned around, because at the very beginning, it doesn't sound like a bad idea. I mean, if you get invaded, I would like to think if we got invaded here in the United States, that someone would be left behind to be able to fight back behind enemy lines and help us retake our territory. You know, it's not going to be peace at any cost. If someone attacks you, you should shoot back. Definitely, that's my attitude. But, you know, to have this get morphed into manipulating the public consciousness, into trying to influence how the public thinks about a particular thing, this is not really the job of these soldiers. And the fact that you have the CIA asking them, according to that story that you related, how they can get involved in manipulating the public consciousness. I mean, this is a foreign intelligence service to the Italians asking them to do that. I mean, it just shows how this thing really turned into something that it was not originally crafted to do. So can you talk a little bit more about the false flag operations that were carried out under Gladio?
Yeah. One really interesting fact to keep in mind is that Italy in 1945 was defeated. So that's the end of the Second World War. And there were a lot of fascists in Italy, so fascists who had actually sided with Mussolini. And the Italian socialists and the communists were very strong because they had fought Mussolini. And the problem for the U.S. was when Italy was liberated in 1945, shortly after, they had the first general elections in Italy in 1948. And the Italians were happy with the socialists and the communists because, you know, they were disgusted, not everybody, but many were disgusted with fascism. So at the election in 1948, there was a huge potential that the communists would win at the poll. But then the CIA, which had been created in 1947, didn't want, you know, the communists to win these first elections. So the CIA manipulated the first elections of Italy. In fact, that was the first job the CIA had. They attacked Italy. And they manipulated this election by creating a new party, which they called the Democrazia Cristiana, which is a very good idea to call it Democrazia because that sounds nice. Just call it democracy. And Christian, if you call it Christian, that's another good idea if you understand Italy, because Italians, most of Italians are Catholics. So they call it Democrazia Cristiana, was a good idea. But it basically was just a CIA-created party. And they made sure that this party won the elections in 1948. And so after that, they could integrate Italy into NATO. Because if you see it from the perspective of London and of Washington, they wanted Italy firmly into NATO, and they didn't want an Italian communist defense minister, for instance, because then this defense minister would have betrayed all secrets of NATO to Moscow. So the design of the strategic planners in the National Security Council in Washington or in British establishment circles was Italy can never have a communist party in government. Now, thing is, Italians, you know, the years go by and they voted again. So after many years, that huge communist group in the parliament, and if you're very strong with one party in the parliament, so that's the Senate or the House of Representatives, then obviously you are entitled to have your party also in the government. You can have defense ministers, you can have interior ministers, you can have foreign ministers. And now Washington didn't want that. And many people in Italy on the right didn't want that either. So what they did is they used manipulated terrorism to keep Italian communists out of the government. That was the point. One specific case. In 1972 in Italy, you have a small village in northern Italy which is called Betteano. And in this small village, you had a car, an abandoned car. And then there was an anonymous call to the police, local police there. Hey, there's a car there. Can you go check? We don't know what this car, what's happening with that car. It's abandoned, has been there for many, many hours. We don't know what's that. So the Carabinieri, which is the Italian military police, went there and opened the door of the car. And that triggered a blast, and this blast killed three carabinieri. So just three policemen were killed. So that was really an attack on the state because the police and the carabinieri are representatives of the state. Shortly after that terrorist attack, I mean, compared to 9/11, obviously it's a very small attack. It's just three people killed and a car, you know, you go like, yeah, so what? But, you know, it's important to understand the mechanism. Shortly after the attack, you had a call, an anonymous call, which said, this is an attack by the Red Brigades, which is a left-wing terrorist organization, which really existed in Italy at the time. And so the police would immediately round up communists in Italy, and the communists were discredited and weakened. You know, that's if you translate this to a 2001 narrative, after 9/11, immediately the Muslims were discredited and rounded up. And at the time of the Cold War, obviously, the role of the Muslims then was the role of the communists. They were immediately discredited. And it took 12 years. It took 12 years for the Peteano case to be reopened by an Italian judge. His name was Felice Casson. And he reinvestigated this terror attack. And he found out that this phone call, the anonymous phone call, had been bogus. Just, you know, nonsense. And in reality, the attack had been carried out by Ordine Nuovo. And Ordine Nuovo is a right-wing terrorist terrorist group in Italy. And the guy who carried out the attack confessed. He said, yes, I did it. Yeah, I did it. And, you know, it was necessary to do this because, you know, we were fighting a war. We were fighting against the communists. And we had to make them look bad. And this guy is called Vincenzo Vinci Guerra. And he's a right-wing terrorist. And it's interesting to listen to these guys because he said, after I had carried out this terrorist attack, the military secret service helped me to escape. You know, they helped me to escape Italy. I went to Spain where you had a dictatorship under Franco, a fascist dictatorship. So I was protected there and had no problem. And that basically shows that the military secret service supported me. And this is a specific example of false flag terrorism. And I, as a historian, I can then show that it, first of all, is possible to create a terrorist attack, to then secondly blame somebody else. I can thirdly show that it takes many, many years until you find out who really did it. And fourth, that you always have people who support the general thinking behind it, who say, okay, maybe it's not nice to kill these people, but the general idea to fight communism is important, you know. And then, this Peteano attack is just one. There are many, many different terrorist attacks in Italy. And it seems that the explosives had been taken out of the arms caches that had been set up for the secret armies. So it's not a direct link from NATO secret armies to every terrorist attack in Italy. It's not that simple. But there is evidence that the secret armies were used internally to manipulate the political climate. And it really worked. There were never communists in the government, never.
Right, and it is amazing to look at the people who get caught doing these things and what their justification to themselves are. I mean, most people listening to the show, I hope, would say, I wouldn't kill a couple of military police officers for anything, but sometimes people get whipped up into a cause, whether it be religion or whether it be service to their government or some lofty goal or some fear of something happening. They rationalize evil things to themselves. And I hope one day when we bust 9/11 open and the perpetrators are dragged before a court of some kind, that we can get that story of why they thought it would be a good idea to lay explosives in those towers, what kind of mental processes were going on to lead them to doing such a thing. I'm really interested in hearing that story.
Judged on the Gladio data, you can be sure that they are convinced that it makes sense in a wider strategic context. That's what I always saw. I mean, in Germany, they recruited people who were Nazis. And they recruited them after World War II because we said, well, we need people who are anti-communists. Now, the Nazis clearly were anti-communists, so they recruited them directly into the Stay Behind network. That makes sense. We take the Nazis from Hitler and we put them into the secret NATO armies. So, you know, you have crazy things going on. And when you look at the people who are involved, they always have a story in their head to justify what they do. Nobody of them ever said, Jesus Christ, that was just stupid. I should never have done that. It was evil. I'm so confused. What am I doing? They said, no, you know, the Cold War was basically a hot war. And in order to fight, we had to discredit the enemy. And, you know, if we just kill three people, that's not a lot. Because think of, you know, an entire war, many more people would have died. So basically it makes a lot of sense. That's what they always have an answer. that's what I've always seen as a story.
You know, really quick, and I'll tell the audience a story. When I was in Washington, D.C., I was coming back from I was in an Uber car being driven by an Iranian guy. But he was talking about his life up in Iran and how he escaped. And all of the fanaticism that was going on and comparing it to some of the political heated arguments going on now, and he said that it's very dangerous when you become too obsessed with what you believe in. When you get just to the point that you start losing your humanity and justifying crazy things. And so I think that's something to always remember throughout history, even for the next 1,000 years, is, you know, look at yourself and what you're doing in the name of your cause, because it may not be the right thing. Now, you mentioned the CIA role in all of this. And I'm going to start a new segment on the show because Wikipedia has a very avid following of people that want to reinforce the official story so that when you go in there and make edits, like for instance, even to our page, someone will change it back almost immediately. So I want to give people a chance to respond when Wikipedia, when they're forced to acknowledge someone's point of view and then they in one fell swoop dismiss it subtly, I want to give that person a chance to respond. So here's what Wikipedia said about you and you're mentioning the CIA's role in this, Gladio. The Central Intelligence Agency responded to the series of accusations made by Ganser in his book regarding the CIA's involvement in Operation Gladio by claiming that neither Ganser nor anyone else could have solid evidence supporting their accusations. At one point in his book, Ganser talks about the CIA's covert action policies as being terrorist in nature and then accuses the CIA of using their networks for political terrorism. The CIA responded by noting that Daniel Ganser's sourcing is largely secondary and that Ganser himself has complained about not being able to find any official sources to support his charges of the CIA's or any Western European government's involvement with Gladio. So what's your response?
Well, that's just not accurate. I mean, the CIA, former CIA director William Colby, he wrote a book called Honorable Men, because, you know, after the overthrow of Allende in Chile in 1973, there was a lot of criticism, the Church Committee, you know, all that. And they were criticizing the CIA for instance, for cooperating with the mafia to kill Fidel Castro, which didn't work out, or to kill Lumumba in Congo in 61, etc. But at that time, Colby was sort of trying to defend the CIA, and he put out a book called Honorable Men, and there he wrote very specifically that he was himself involved as a young CIA operative with setting up the State Behind Network. So the link from the CIA to Operation Gladio is proven. It's proven by former CIA people, and it's proven also by documents in Italy. So that's the first point. But the second point, it is very difficult to prove the link of the CIA to specific terrorist attack. I mean, you were talking about Iran, that you met somebody while you were having a cup. But if you look at the data from Iran, you see when the CIA overthrew the government of Mossadegh in Iran in 1953, they also carried out false flag terrorist attacks. What they did in Tehran, in the capital of Iran, and this has been now proven, is that they, you know, dressed up as Muslims and carried out terrorist attacks and then sort of created fear and anxiety in the whole city. That was in 1953. And in Italy, my understanding is that they used Italians to do the very, very same thing. We have former heads from Italian secret services. One guy is called Gian Delio Maletti, and he's obviously speaking in Italian, so most people have never heard from him. But he, in 2001, in March, said, let me quote this here, he said, the CIA, following the directives of its government, wanted to create an Italian nationalism capable of halting what it saw as a slide to the left. And for this purpose, it may have made use of right-wing terrorism. So he was talking about the Piazza Fontana terrorist attack, which happened in 69. And it's just important to realize that he is a high-ranking former head of Italian counterintelligence. And he says the Americans, the impression was that the Americans, meaning the CIA, would do anything to stop Italy from sliding to the left. So this is this whole strategic context that they didn't want the communists in power, because otherwise the communists, the Italian communists, would have weakened NATO from within. And he added, "Don't by the 69." He said, "Don't forget that Nixon was in charge, and Nixon was a strange man, a very intelligent politician, but a man of rather unorthodox initiatives." And, you know, Maletti, when he said it, was 70 years old, and being a Christian and a Catholic, he was probably thinking about what have I done in my whole life, and was it right what I did, and he had some regrets. So he said, Italy has been dealt with as a sort of protectorate of the United States. I'm ashamed to think that we are still subject to special supervision. So there's a lot of data in Italy that talks about the role of the CIA in Italy during the Cold War. And I think just my Wikipedia entry is just not accurate, but I don't really have the time to correct it. And even if you try, I mean, I didn't read the English entry on my person, but the German entry, it says, you know, he's spreading conspiracy theories regarding 9/11. Whereas the only thing that I've said is World Trade Center 7 was, according to my conviction, blown up with controlled demolition. And, you know, instead that they write that, they could write, you know, he's of the opinion that World Trade Center 7 was blown up, that'd be correct. But they just slander people. So really, Wikipedia, unfortunately, is a bit of a disappointment. They don't help in this research.
Right. And, I mean, Wikipedia is good if you want to get some non-controversial issue information, like the distance between the Earth and the Moon. But if you want to get into history, I mean, when you read it, you can almost hear the snake voice from the Jungle Book, that low slithering voice. So you can hear that voice in your head as you're reading the words talking about dismissing conspiracy theories. And that's why I want to give people a chance to respond, because Wikipedia doesn't control this show. So, very good there. Now, you mentioned also about the CIA being involved in Iran. They absolutely were. And this is why it's so dangerous to be so obsessed with what you believe in, because it makes you easier to manipulate, because then they can just get someone in there and say, hey, we're doing it for this or that reason, we're doing it for the cause, but you're really not doing it for your cause, you're doing it for someone else's cause that may have nothing to do with what you believe the reasons are. And I know this goes on, and it's easy to stir people up, play on emotions, play on resentments that may exist over other matters, and get an outcome that you want by just slipping a few well-placed agents in and causing problems. Now, you may have mentioned this or alluded to it in the beginning, but give some finality to the story here that we're presenting. How did this get busted wide open?
The thing is, it really was this terrorist attack in Peteano. This was, like, you know, happening in 72. I think that is important for 9/11 researchers to understand that it always takes a long time. So the terrorist attack happened in 72, very small terrorist attack compared to 9/11, three dead. And then 12 years, a story which is total bogus, which said, you know, the left brigades were it. They didn't do it. They were not. That was false flag. Then after 12 years, you have Judge Felice Casson reopens the case, and he actually gets permission from the Italian prime minister to research in the archives of the military secret service. I mean, it's really crazy that he got this permission, but he got it. Still don't know why, but he got it. And then in the Italian, in the archive of the military secret service, I mean, that's a dream for every historian. Let me in the archive of the military secret service, of the NSA, of the CIA. Anyway, he got the permission, and then he could prove that Peteano was false flag terrorism, and then he could actually trace down Felice Casson, the guy who did it, Vincenzo Vinci Guerra. Vinci Guerra, by the way, means the win the war. Vinci, win, and guerra, war. Vinci Guerra. So he's the guy who carried it out. And Vinci Guerra then said, and it was very interesting, he said, and this whole thing is linked to a larger structure of secret armies which exist all over Western Europe. And he said that on trial in the 80s. And everybody was like, yeah, come on, why not? Have you been watching television for too much? And he just insisted and said, you know, they protect us, NATO protects us. We're sort of shadow soldiers, but they protect us. And then the judge took that seriously and said, if this right-wing terrorist says that NATO and elements of the Secret Service are involved in this, then I'll dig deeper. And he did, and he came out with a story, and he could really prove that NATO had secret armies. And then the Prime Minister, Giulio Andreotti, and also NATO military command were forced to confirm, yes, okay, we did that. We have these secret armies. Yes, we have the armed caches, because it was already all proven. And then they just, as a communication strategy, said, but the only thing that we did was we waited for a Soviet invasion. And, you know, that's still the line they try to play. They say, yes, we did that. We just prepared it, and we never used it, really. I mean, trust us, we would never use it. But that is obviously a lie. They used this very same structure to influence domestic politics. But it was really blown into the open by Felice Casson. And Ferdinando Imposimato is another judge in Italy. We have very, very good judges in Italy because they were fighting the mafia. They were fighting many, many crimes. And they tried to get to the bottom. They tried to get to the truth. And I think Ferdinando Imposimato has also very clearly said that what happened on 9/11 reminds him very much on what happened with Operation Gladio, which basically means that the secret services are able to strike fear to the bones of the population by creating terrorism through, you know, intermediaries. They don't have to do it themselves. They have a whole lot of people who can do it for them. And then to manipulate the media and blame somebody else. And I think this knowledge that comes from Italy and can actually help the United States, because it's knowledge that is in Italian sources. But once you remember the name Operation Gladio, I mean, you know, everybody can only just take something out of an interview. But Operation Gladio is really the key frame. And if you remember that, you can go from there and dig deeper.
Now, I know there's going to be people that are interested in hearing more about this and hearing more of your work. How can they follow you?
I have a YouTube channel, which is Daniele, which is my first name. It is like Daniel and then E at the end. This is because I was born in the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland. So there, Daniel turns into Daniele. So it's Italian. And my second name is Ganser, Ganser. So they can just go on any search engine and put in my first name and my second name, and then add Gladio, and they will find data from on there. You know, most of my talks are in German. I have like 30 talks on YouTube, but a few are in Italian, are in English actually. But most of my work on Operation Gladio is just in writing, so they unfortunately have to read the book.
Hey, there is nothing wrong with reading books. I think it's actually better than watching television.
It is the best. Yeah,
reading books is the best. But it's best, you know, some people, if they have a book of 300 pages, it scares them. I don't know why, but it's the best. I mean, if you want to educate yourself, get good books. That's always what I said to my students.
Well, everybody wants to be wired in now. I think it's better to just, it's good to listen to things off of the internet, to lectures and whatnot, but there's nothing better than sitting outside and reading something and actually enjoying the solitude and being able to soak up the information. So I think we need to go back to that in our society. I think everyone's kind of so wired in right now that their brains are getting fried, but anyway, Daniel Ganser, this has been a fascinating hour for me personally, and I want to look even more into this topic, more than I already know, and I'm sure the audience feels the same way. So thank you so much for coming on 9/11 Freefall today.
Yes, thank you very much for having me, and thank you very much for all the important research that you educate your readers. I think that's the only good thing about the whole thing. We educate ourselves and we educate our friends in a way we would probably never have done if this was not the time we lived in. You know, I always try to see the positive thing. I mean, we're crazy times, but these are times that we get educated about issues that our parents didn't even think about.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, and every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. Have a great week and good luck.